Mr. Rayner Taylor, reel 18. You were talking about your visit to Kipling's house after the war.
And the next thing, after that, we left, we saw him on the way. But to me, the fact that I'd met Rudyard Kipling, it didn't register anything, really. I knew him as Kipling, but I didn't realise what an important man he was. It didn't register at all until afterwards, you know. And that, as I say, that part of the poem which says, and lose, and start again at the beginning, and never say a word about your loss. Do you know, Rudyard Kipling never said he lost his only son. He never mentioned it when we were there. Now, that's a bit of something. He never mentioned that he lost his son. But he had.
And you only found out when you saw the grave?
I didn't know that he... I didn't even know he had us. I didn't never know he had his son until the organiser of this tour, this year, said that Rudyard Kipling's son was buried there. And after, I believe, I've made a lot of inquiries, various sources, about this. And I believe that the loss of his son, the end of the war, it altered Rudyard Kipling's life and character. Previously, he was a great empire man, you know. He's noted for that, his writings, he's very empire conscious. And I think because of his age, and he had nobody, he had no family, he became a bit of a recluse. It was sad because it was sad because he was such a nice fella.
And you feel he was living up to his own poem then by not mentioning it?
Yes, I do. Although I didn't, I think now that, because I didn't know then that he had lost anybody. He never gave us any inkling.
You didn't recognise him at all, because he was quite well known, Kipling, at the time, I mean.
Oh, yes. I knew him when he said that. When he said, he never mentioned his name. He said, I like it better today than the day I wrote it. And I knew immediately who he was. And we just chatted. He was just a...
Do you remember anything else he said?
No, I can't. Actually, he gave us a good meal. He gave me something to talk about for the rest of my life. Certainly did.
Is there anything else you remember about your time in POW camps?
Oh, yes. Not in POW, because you could be in a camp and then the next, they'd find another job where you would be required.
So you weren't at any one place long?
No, not long in any one place. We went to... In the meantime, I think it was during that period when I was detailed for these duties as Batman. There were few of us, you know, and that's when we went with this military mission.
Now, was that before or after you'd been on passport duty at Folkestone?
It would be before.
Because that's where you met Lloyd George.
Oh, yes. That was... Before.
You went to Russia before?
Before, yes, because they were trying...
Well, before we get to that, do you remember when the war actually ended, Armistice Day? Do you have any memories of that?
Vaguely. It seemed to me to be...
You were in a camp, were you?
Oh, yes. I think... I don't know where I was then. I know. We went up to London, and we didn't buy a rail ticket. We just got a train, and it was free for all, you know that. And
what was it like? What can you remember
about? Oh, chaos! The buses, omnibuses, open tops. Then you know, packed with people. The taxis. any moving vehicle were smothered with people shouting and celebrating. It was nothing else but that.
Where did you go to in London, do you know?
Oh, no idea. No idea at all.
Did you feel happy? Because your brother was still missing at this time,
was
wasn't he?
Still missing, yes.
How did you feel then on Armistice Day?
Well, like everybody else, the war was over. Yeah.
So you were pleased?
Oh, yes.
Did you get drunk, or...?
I don't think so. No, I don't think... a couple of gills and that would be enough, you know. No. But there were plenty of getting drunk, and beer were flowing, and... I have a feeling that people in uniform could have anything. And mind you, there seemed to be more people in uniform than there were civilians. Where they all came from, I don't know. There were soldiers and sailors and nurses and all the ancillary work. Anybody in uniform, of course, they were, did the freedom of the city. They really had. I'm speaking in my case, and the lads who had told me we had no money. We'd get a meal, a sandwich of some sort off somebody, and we didn't bother about anything like that. It was one silly, mad celebration, and it went on for a day or two, and then it tailed off, and you went back to it, and gradually...
Were you in trouble at all when you went
back? No, nobody... No, everybody... Discipline were gone by the board.
What about the prisoners? How did they feel about it?
Well, they were the same, because it did cause some concern, because they thought they'd be going home the next day. It couldn't be.
Why not?
No transport. We no transport. We wanted transport to bring our fellows home. On the usual supply vessels. There was no, so much so that they didn't even provide transport for our own prisoners of war. They didn't. Because our Albert told me, when the armistice was signed, the Germans, they just opened the gates of the prison. And they went, they vanished, left them to their own devices. And what they did, they found out the nearest way to the coast. And as I understood it, they walked across Holland, and they walked.
You mentioned that, because we had that story earlier. Now, did you think you'd be demobilised at the end of the war, or did you realise...
Very early, there was a scheme, and I think it had been prepared during the war for the demobilisation. And so you realised demobilisation was in stages. I think first and foremost was skill men, get them back into industry. And then married men of a certain age, you know, and then it gradually went down that way. And then it came a case of how long you'd been in, how long it was before you went out. And it was a phased demobilisation.
And how long was it before you realised you were going to be quite late in this?
Well, it came on you gradually. You knew what were coming, you know.
Right, well, when did you... And it was after the war ended that you got put on this business. You carried on in the prison of war camps for a while. Then when was it that you got made a Batman? That was in 1919.
Oh, yes, it was in 1919.
When about? Do you remember?
Oh, early 1919.
And what was your job as a Batman? Do you know where you had to go?
No, I don't. I don't even know the officers who were on it. All I know is that they were going, or they told us they were going... to disengage the North British Expeditionary Force. And
North
they were
Russian.
Based at Murmansk. and they were under the direction or attached to what was then known as the White Russians. I know the name of the man who commanded the White Russians. He was called Kerensky. And he was fighting what became known as the Bolsheviks, or the Reds. And when it became evident that the Reds were going to win, then they tried to disengage this our expeditionary force. And they had quite a job on, because nowhere would the Russians cooperate.
Oh, now, no. What happened to you, though?
We came back.
No, but we haven't gone yet. Well, you see what I mean? What? You were recruited as a batman. And what
We gathered at... I'm not sure whether Gravesend or not. I'm not sure. We went on this ship. And our job was to see to these officers. And
what would you do for them? Can you remember what your job was as a batman?
Well, keeping the clothes clean and tidy, and the general batman's duties, and that's what they're meant to, you know.
Did you mind that, being officer's servant?
I minded it because I was going on the sea and I didn't want that.
Why not?
Oh, I'm always sick on the sea. I was sick all the way. All the way.
You wouldn't be much use as a batman, then?
No use whatever. I was no use to myself, never mind them. And
The ship went up to Murmansk. Do you remember its name?
I don't know. I've no idea of that. But I do know this. That I was walking on the dockside at Murmansk. By this time, this mission, they were in conference with whoever it was, and we had some little time, but we never were let off the dockside, you know. And I remember my voice saying, "Hey, what the bloody hell are they doing here?" And it was Bill Rushworth.
This is your friend who died recently.
Yeah. And I'd never seen him from the day he joined the Navy in 1914. I'd never seen him till then.
And what
remarkable.
Was he? He was a Royal Marine. Navy.
He was a Royal Marine, but he was serving afloat then. Bill. And then we came back from there.
What did you actually do while you were there?
Nothing.
You never left the dockside?
No. My view of them, they were a surly lot of people.
Who were?
The Russians. They didn't... You got no cooperation of them at all.
This is the White Russians?
Yes. I, Murmansk at that time, was under the... It was under the control of the White Russians then, but they wouldn't...
Were you living on board ship? Or
yes.
So you never left the ship?
No,
right?
not too for any length of time, no.
Did you do anything at all while you were there?
No, not to my knowledge. No. Eventually, this mission was aborted and we came home. It didn't last very long, you know. I came home and...
So you went out quite late
to
join it?
And They had to get this expeditionary force out the best way they could, and I believe it wasn't quite a Dunkirk, but it was quite, they had quite a job on getting them out, you know.
And did you see any of this?
No.
So really, for you, it was a bit of a non-event.
Oh yes, it was a non-event, except being seasick all the way over.
Were you sick all the way back?
All the way back. I'm terrified of the sea. I really am. I don't like it. I think the thoughts of it makes me... I was even sick on the landing stage at New Brighton once, and it's a floating landing stage. I was sick on there. It just as gentle. I was sick on there. No, I wasn't. I'm not a good sailor.
And about how long were you away on that?
About 3 weeks.
So that's quite late in 1919, then.
No, not very late, because the peace treaty was signed in July. No, it wasn't very late. We came back from there, and it was then when one of the jobs was his passport duty at Folkestone.
What did that involve?
Well, that involved examining people who wanted to go to France. You must remember... France was a non-starter for civilians going during the war. And there were a lot of people had relatives and friends and business interests who wanted to go to France for personal reasons. And they'd got to get a pass to go, and they got to have a passport. And it was our job to examine these passports, because they're a bit strict on that.
And you were still in uniform?
Oh, yes, yes.
How did it all work then? Where was your passport office, or whatever?
Right on the station.
The train station?
Oh, yes. In fact, the last time I was at Folkestone, I went to look at it, there's a big hotel just outside the station, and I remember being there one night. But we had a hut where the guards used to go, you know, you had your own times for being on duty. You know, anybody coming into the station, they'd have to come through the gate, and you examined all the passes for the vehicles. That was the job. There'd probably, might be about 50 of us, and we had, the duties were split up, you know.
And what would you check on the passes and passports? What were you actually doing to them?
Well, to see whether they were valid, see whether they got the right stamps on them.
Would many of them be going across to see where their husbands or sons were buried?
Yes, but we came across odd people like that, but that didn't. That became greater as the organised boat. Those things weren't done until they tidied the battlefields up, because...
So your people were mainly commercial?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I understand the passports were pretty much the same as they are now. What were these passes you talk about, though?
Permission to visit, besides the passport, they got to have permission to go to...
Like a visa?
Oh, yes, yes. And they were issued sparingly, because... Quite honestly, they'd enough to do dealing with the military traffic. They'd enough to do without bothering my people wanting to pay a visit.
What did they go on? Cross Channel ferries?
Yes, or sometimes they managed to get on a leave boat, because there were still people. We still had an army there, you know. And
Would many people not have the right documentation?
Oh, yes, quite a lot. And if they hadn't, they wouldn't. A case in point, on the day that the peace delegation came back, I was on duty at the gate for a start off. And there was a corporal in charge at the gate. And these vehicles were coming through. And one came through. And we stopped it. And there was a man, very so-so. And we asked him for his passport. Didn't have one. Pass. Didn't have one. Well, he couldn't go through. Now, this corporal, he were hard-headed, spoke with a broad Lancashire accent. He says, if there's no pass, they cannot go through. No way, you're not going. And this man said, do you know who I am? He said, I don't care who they are. If there's no pass, they're not going. And he said he was the mayor of Folkestone, he said, and he was part of the welcoming party for the Prime Minister. He said, I don't care, anybody could say that, they're not going. And he wouldn't let him go through, and he turned the mayor of Folkestone away. Now, about that time, I and several were withdrawn to line up on the dockside, so I don't know how eventually, whether he did get in, but his dignity were very indented with this, and he was a little this call, that not going in, and he would not let him through, and he turned the mayor's car away, He said, there's no path they're not going through.
Now, you were forming a sort of guard of honour, were you?
Well, no, it wasn't the guard of honour. You see, there's the dockside where the ships, they come and die. Well, we were lined up along the dockside. Whether we weren't close together. That maybe one man here, one man about as far as that wall.
About 2 or 3 yards.
Oh, yes. Of course, as the crowds began to gather, and when I say the crowds, they were a rather well-dressed body of people, because a train had come in and it drew in at the dockside station, and there were people of note got off this train, and they were part of the welcoming delegation. The cabinet and all the hierarchy, they were there to be, because this was a big thing. Peace had been signed and the British delegation was coming home. Now, it didn't register then to me as it does now. It was just something that these lot of... I didn't pay a great deal of attention. It was a job. And I tell you, I knew the boat. It was called the Brighton. SS Brighton. Steamship Brighton. And it was a paddle steamer. And there was quite a massive press of people, you know, waiting for it to come in. And they didn't seem to be able to bring a paddle steamer in quite as easily as they can bring a screw, you know. They had to almost push it in sideways, and it also had to go a bit on the skew like that, because you've got to get a part of the boat where you can get the gangway on. And it so happened it came in right where I was stood. And of course, when they wheel this gangway up, naturally the people there, the people who were in that power, some went that way and some went this way. So eventually we came out. The gangway's here. We stood here. Well, I was on that part, and I came on this side where the gangway's going, and I'm lined up here, about halfway down the gangway. The line of guards was drawn because of those on the other side of the gangway. If it sounds a bit confused, it's because it was confusing. Anyway, the boat eventually got in, and it's then I saw one of the most undignified scenes I've ever seen. More I think about it now, and I think how undignified it was. The senior members of the cabinet were there to welcome Lloyd George. Now, the gangway would only take one at a time. And there's two of them dragging on at once. Protocol, I think they call it. Who had seniority? It was dead funny. And I know one of the men. I know him. It was Jan Smuts, General Smuts, who had been co-opted to our war cabinet from South Africa. These are facts that I found out afterwards.
You didn't recognise him at the time?
Oh, yes. His face was so... It was familiar to everybody.
So you did know him?
Oh, I did know him.
What about the other one?
Well, I don't know who the other one was. I don't know, but I do know it was... And they eventually went on this. And the other people followed them. But it was these two going on first. Who had to go first? Reading the memoirs of Lloyd George, for instance, Smuts played a big part in our war effort. Very big part indeed.
So when they'd gone on, what happened then?
Well, there was a period of waiting. You could only presume what was happening in the cabin or staterooms. You could just imagine them. having drinks and congratulating one another and saying what good lads they were. And eventually, after guessing quite a while, the party emerged from this. Well, everybody cheered to see Lloyd George came out first. And he had a commanding figure. Not tall, in fact, he's very small, but stumpy. White hair and a white moustache. He stood out in the crowd. And he came along, and there was a step to where the gangway was. And he got on this, and he came on the, got on the gangway. And of course, everybody's cheering like mad. And he's walking down this gangway, and I'm halfway down. And when he got right opposite me, he stopped. Now, believe me, I was petrified. I didn't know. I was wondering, well, had I done something wrong? I really thought I had. I'd committed some misdemeanour, whatever they call it. But no, he said to me, or words to that effect, wonderful. And he spoke in a very Welsh accent, which is a lilting, well, you know what I say. Wonderful, the Welsh boy. And I didn't realise what he was talking about. I did afterwards. I found out it was because, as he passed me, my cap badge is rather a big Prince of Wales feathers, the cap badge of the Welsh Regiment. And underneath it says, the Welsh. And it's silver-coloured. It's pretty outstanding. And apparently he'd seen that, and he thought that they'd brought a Welsh contingent to act as a guard of honour. And he really thought that.
Did he say anything?
He said, what part of Wales do you come from, boy? And I'm trying to say like him, what part of Wales do you come from, boy? And you know, I froze. I didn't know what to say. And I said, I don't come from Wales, sir. near. Yeah. Don't come from Wales. Don't come from Wales. I said, no, sir. Yes. Where do you come from? And I said, near Manchester. Well, I couldn't have said anything better. Manchester? I was born there. I didn't know Lord George very much, you know. I was born there. And you live in Manchester. Where in Manchester? Well, it's not Manchester. It's Oldham. Oh, I'm in Oldham many times. I know Oldham. I know Oldham. And he parroted on. Where? The cabinet's behind him. There he's parroting to me about where he'd been born. And, of course, when he...
How long did he speak to you for?
It seemed a long while, but he speaks as long to me as I mean telling you that. That's about the length of time, you know.
Couple of minutes.
Oh, yes. And when, of course, when he streamed off, you know, they opened the ranks and they were patting him on the back and the women were trying to get at him. And they were all women, the members of the high rank, you know. They weren't the... They weren't the anything Aryans. And then the number. What did he say to you? What did he want to know? Asking me.
Well, the crowd were asking.
Oh, yes. And they eventually. I'll tell you what he did. Before he went, he pulled a photograph out of his pocket. Oh, God, I am mad about this. He pulled a photograph out of his pocket, a postcard sized photograph, and he wrote on it, David L. George, I think that was it, David L. George. And he tore it in halves, and he gave me half. He says, keep that, boy. Well, I believe he gave the other half to somebody as had